Thank you for tuning in to this very special episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. This is a audio recording of a live podcast that was recorded on October 28th at the Idaho Youth Ranch Building, an old abandoned building here on Main Avenue in Twin Falls, Idaho, in which this event was recorded in front of a live audience. So I conducted two interviews, and in this episode you're listening to is going to be the first half of this event with Dar Jamail. And I'll provide an introduction to who Dar is at the beginning of this recording, so I don't need to get into that at this exact moment. But this is a very unique thing. This is something that, you know, I've never done before. So doing an interview in front of a live audience and having them participate through asking questions at the end, both in person with the people there, as well as those participating through the live stream of the event. So again, it adds a whole new element, a whole new dynamic to it. So I would ask that if you want to watch, because this whole thing was recorded on video, if you want to watch this event and have that other dimension, that other element of the experience added to your listening of this, please go down to the link below. It's in the description to the YouTube link. And also, if you just go to the website, lastborninthewilderness.com, you'll find it there. And yeah, I don't know what else to add, except if you want to support this project, you can do so at the Last Born in the Wilderness Patreon page, which is patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And by going there, you can make very small monthly contributions to the production of this podcast. This is an ad-free, sponsor-free production, so it relies completely on donations on those that are invested in the continuation of this project. For those that are already contributing, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. There have been a few new patrons recently that I just want to thank you. I met my first goal on the Patreon, which is to make over $100 a month, which is now where I'm at, which is amazing. The next goal is to get to like 500. You know, at some point, the dream, the pipe dream, if you want to say it in that way as well, is that I'll be able to actually live off of producing this thing, and then I could spend a lot more time doing things like live podcasts, doing more interviews, spending more time with this project and cultivating the ideas that come out of this thing. Yeah, so this event was amazing. Part two is going to be with Dr. Bones, the one and only legendary gonzo journalist, conjurer, anarcho-communist, egoist Dr. Bones. Part two is going to be there as well, and there's a video of that as well. So this whole thing is meant to be listened from part one to part two. The whole thing is like a theme, right? Which is another end of the world is possible. That's how this thing is meant to be viewed. So please consider jumping right into the second episode as soon as you can with Dr. Bones. I thank you for your attention up to this point. On with the episode. All right, so this is a really new thing for me. I did a public talk earlier this year in April, and that was a good experience for me to realize that I actually could do something like this, that I could engage in with an audience and have a conversation about subjects that I feel need to be discussed in this time that we're in. So doing a live podcast is a bit of a dream come true, but the subjects that we're going to discuss are going to be a bit heavy and difficult. So the idea, of course, is to open it up to audience participation. So just to give you a layout of how this is going to work, first I'm going to be speaking with Dar Jamail, who we've got here, speaking to us live, I believe, from Washington. And then we're going to do a Q&A in the last 15 minutes of our hour with him. So people here in the audience, you'll have an opportunity to ask him a question. If I'm sure you're going to have questions come up during this thing. And for those that are here on the live stream, thank you for tuning in. We'll also have questions coming from you. You can participate through the chat on this thing. Yeah, and I would just like to thank one person in particular, which is Jordan Thornquist. He's kind of behind the scenes. He's the man behind the curtain doing everything that's made this whole thing possible. He was the first person to suggest this this whole thing earlier this year. I didn't take it very seriously at first, but as time went on, it really started to make sense. This is something that we need to do. Okay, so I'll just introduce our guest, Dar Jamail. Get out my notes. All right, so I've spoken with Dar previously. I actually featured a segment of our interview that we had earlier this year in my TEDx talk. I think it really added a lot of weight to what I was discussing in that talk. So in late 2003, weary of the overall failure of the U.S. media to accurately report on the realities of the war in Iraq for the Iraqi people, Darjamil went to the Middle East to report on the war himself, where he has spent more than 1 year in Iraq as one of only a few independent U.S. journalists in the country. Dar has also reported from Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. He has also reported extensively on veterans' resistance against U.S. foreign policy. It has now focused on anthropogenic climate disruption and the environment. Dar's stories have been published with Truthout, Interpress Service, Tom Dispatch, The Sunday Herald in Scotland, The Guardian, Foreign Policy in Focus, Le Monde, The Huffington Post, The Nation, The Independent, and Al Jazeera, among others. On radio as well as television, Dar has reported for Democracy Now! And Al Jazeera, and has appeared on the BBC, NPR, and numerous other stations around the world. Dar's reporting has earned him numerous awards, including the 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the Lannan Foundation Writing Residency Fellowship, the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism, the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage, and 5 Project Censored Awards. In Dar's upcoming book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, Dar embarks on a journey to the geographical front lines of the global climate crisis from Alaska to Australia's Barrier Reef via the Amazon forest, rainforest, in order to discover the consequences to nature and to humans of the loss of ice. Howard Zinn describes him, he is a superb journalist in the most honorable tradition of that craft. Dar, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Patrick. Good to be with you, and thanks for the great, very warm introduction.
Yeah, well, I just lifted that from your website. I think that was a good introduction for who you are and what you've done. I've got a couple people here walking in. Hey, Paul. Hey, Arnell. All right, so I think to start off this discussion, I think it's important to lay out kind of the context. So you use a term when you do your climate dispatches. So you write regularly for Truthout. You provide pretty regular updates of what's going on regarding abrupt climate disruption. You use that term very specifically, abrupt climate disruption, versus a more broad term like global warming or climate change. What exactly do you mean by using the term abrupt climate disruption?
Right. I kind of interchangeably between abrupt climate disruption and anthropogenic, which means human-caused climate disruption. And I moved back to the United States from writing about climate change overseas for Al Jazeera English. And coming into the United States specifically, I felt like I needed to be as scientifically accurate as possible, given the power of the fossil fuel industry, the lobby groups, and the influence on the media, and how they had essentially managed to use the words climate change to kind of cast out kind of that nonsensical, well, climate is always changing. So it was basically an effort of just being as scientifically accurate as possible. So anthropogenic, human cause, that's clear. Climate disruption, because what we've done is disrupted the climate of the planet. In some areas you might see even colder temperatures. Of course, overall, as the planet warms, that's what we're seeing. But essentially, we've kind of, to use an analogy, we've kind of thrown the climate into a bit of fibrillation. And so it's disrupted. It's not only warm. Sometimes it's going to be colder. So that was basically just my effort to be as scientifically accurate as possible.
Right. That reminds me of, I think, a Senator Inhofe a few years ago came to the Senate. Big climate change denier, brought a snowball because it was winter, brought it into the Senate, threw it, and was trying to basically say, so much for global warming, right? You know, we don't have seasons anymore, obviously. I think that kind of level of simplification and denialism is still common, but I think as the climate, like you mentioned, is becoming much more... It's disruptive. I mean, we're seeing more severe hurricanes, more severe situations with wildfires. You can go on down the list and see the erratic nature of abrupt climate change, as you point out in your work. And I want to point to something. There have been several stories that have come out more recently regarding the subject. You know, the IPCC, which stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that is a UN body of scientists, and they release a report every few years. They just released a report within the last month or so, I believe. I just want to quote, this is from the press release, okay? This is discussing the differences between a, say, 1.5C to, say, a 2-degree C global average temperature rise. So this is just from the press release. The IPCC just released a report. The report highlights a number of climate change impacts that could be avoided by limiting global warming to 1.5C compared to 2 degrees centigrade or more. For instance, by 2100, global sea level rise would be 10 centimeters lower with global warming of 1.5 degrees C compared to, with 2 degrees C. The likelihood of an Arctic Ocean free of sea ice in summer would be once per century with global warming of 1.5C compared with at least once per decade with 2 degrees centigrade. Coral reefs would decline by 70 to 90% with global warming of 1.5C, whereas virtually all, 99%, would be lost with a 2 degrees centigrade rise in temperature. Every extra bit of warming matters, especially since warming of 1.5C or higher increases the risk associated with long-lasting or irreversible changes, such as the loss of some ecosystems, said Hans Otto Portner, the co-chair of IPCC Working Group 2. So the thing about the IPCC and what I kind of understand is that it's a pretty conservative report, and even for as conservative as it is, it's still quite dire. What is your opinion on that report? What do you make of the comparisons between 1.5 to 2 degrees centigrade in temperature?
Well, I would echo what you just said. I've written about how the IPCC, and this is even coming from people who are authors of IPCC reports and studies, and their main climate assessments come out every 7 years. The thing about this report that I think people need to understand that as alarming and dire as it is, that there's nothing new in it. They didn't generate any new information. They basically just took what they already had and put it together in a way to try to resound the alarm that they had hoped previous reports had sounded, which is the absolute necessity to try to aim to limit warming to 1.5C as opposed to 2C or 4C, which is the trajectory we're currently on, because there is a massive, massive difference in global implications between 1.5C warming and 2C warming, as you just read. So as dire as those are, I just want to reiterate that this is basically science by committee, if you will, in the IPCC. This is very old data. Some of it's more than 10 years old that they're using to make these projections and assessments. And then when they take all that data into their reports, it's an extremely politicized body. So when you have a country like the United States is going to come in and, of course, lobby with everything they're worth to go with the least severe ramifications of this data, instead of really showing what could happen and warning against the worst case scenario. And this is why specifically every IPCC assessment that's come out, reality has actually outpaced its worst case future projections. So as we catch up with what they had projected for the year 2000 or the year 2010 or coming up to 2020, we're actually ahead of all their previous worst case projections. And that's a trend that I fully expect us to continue into the future. Not just me, but some of the authors of IPCC reports whom I've interviewed.
Right. And something they mention in this, just the part that I quoted here, they discuss an ice-free Arctic. And from what I could tell, just based on the graphs that come out every year, that sea ice extent just diminishes pretty dramatically. Could you please explain the significance, I guess maybe to frame this using the term canary in the coal mine, right? Something that's really sounding the alarm that we should really use as an indication that the climate is radically changing. The Arctic is a very good example. If you could please discuss the danger of having a little to no ice in the Arctic region, it'd be great.
Well, we are on track. The most recent graphs that we have, including data from this year, show the current projection is that we're set up to start having ice-free periods in the summer of Arctic sea ice within about 5 years from right now. And it could be sooner, but the current projections, looking at trends and minimum extents and minimum volumes, et cetera, show it to be beginning to happen within 5 years from right now. Why so many people are fixated on Arctic sea ice, myself included, is because there's several very, very worrisome things that are set to happen once that's gone. And we're already actually seeing them start to happen, but that they will only accelerate when there's periods of no Arctic sea ice in the summer. The first and most important, I feel, is that sea ice is basically reflecting back sunlight and the heat with it from going down into the water and getting into the shallow seas and warming them up to a point where the massive amounts of methane hydrates that are frozen into that subsea permafrost. Once that starts melting and those get released, methane is 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide on a 10-year time scale, and it's still 20 times as potent on a 100-year time scale. And once that methane starts getting released en masse, then we're essentially replicating the key extinction driver during the Permian mass extinction 252 million years ago, which wiped out 90% of all life on Earth, most of it in the oceans. And we are, as I said, on track to replicating that. Even this summer, we've seen lakes now in the Arctic that are literally bubbling because permafrost underneath them is melting and releasing methane that's coming up through the water. Other areas in subsea, we're already seeing releases. This has actually been happening for several years now, but it's now accelerating. So for this to happen across the Arctic, and especially once we have that sea ice completely gone for periods during the summer, then we're at grave risk of that happening all across the shallow seas of the Arctic. So that's number one. Number two, it shifts weather patterns globally, and it's also causing things like, you know, as Greenland melts and as that steady trend of overall melting in Greenland is continuing. Of course, it vacillates year to year, but overall, we see a consistent downward trend as far as increasing melting with Greenland. And then that's causing a disruption of the Atlantic Meridional Ocean Circulation Current, the AMOC, which is a giant circulating current from the Atlantic. And as that slows down, that is going to affect weather patterns dramatically, particularly in northwestern Europe and northern Europe. So there's going to be major weather pattern shifts. And along with that comes rainfall patterns shifting across the globe. So food supplies are going to be impacted, et cetera. And that's still a very cursory glance, but that gives you an idea of how important it is that the sea ice remain intact. And the unfortunate reality that we're looking at is that it is on its way out. And the things that I described are appearing to be inevitable. I think it's just a question of when.
Right. It is a question of when, but it does seem like this is coming up within our lifetimes. You know, oftentimes we project this out into, oh, this is 2100, or this is going to be our grandchildren that are going to have to deal with this this problem. This is happening right now. This is manifesting right now. I think oftentimes when you read about climate change in any report, in any mainstream publication, it's projected into the future. But we're starting to see those effects play out in the present. I mean, we have wildfires that are breaking records every year here North American continent. We're seeing wildfires up in the Arctic circle. Is that right?
That's right.
And that's, I guess maybe to point on this, I think we as human beings have a hard time cognitively understanding exponential change or nonlinear change. We tend to think very linearly about these things, like it's going to gradually warm, things are gradually going to change, we're going to have gradual sea rise. That's how we, in an evolutionary sense, understand this information. But what is disturbing is that we are not cognitively capable, it seems, at least initially, to understand the very rapid change that is happening and how quickly that's going to cause massive societal change, collapse of infrastructure, the inability to get something like food, the way our whole agricultural system, our whole socioeconomic system is structured. We will not be able to have access to things that we absolutely rely upon, like grain, right? Like so much of our food comes from that particular source. If you just had a comment on exponential change and, pointing to what we discussed with the Arctic, but like understanding how rapidly this is going to play out, if you can give us some kind of understanding of that, that'd be great.
I think that's a very important point, and I think I can share a story that will really help illustrate it. I share this with some humility because I thought, given all the research that I do and have done about climate change for my book, for the Write for Truth Out, I felt like I had a very deep knowing of, yes, all these things that we've been talking about in the future, they're already starting to happen now. I get that. But I didn't, something happened actually this summer that kind of underscored that I didn't really get it. And I think it's because until something happened directly to me that was overtly climate related, that needed to happen for it to sink in. And what happened was I was writing about this. I had done so much research for my book, pulled it all together. And again, I was confronted with a lot of despair and grief and depression. And so I took a couple of days off work. I took some mental health days and I went to go climb a mountain in the Cascades, which late summer, Pacific Northwest, one would think wildfires and wildfire smoke might not be such a big issue. So I went into the mountains to seek solace. And while I was there, I was going to stay two nights, but wildfire smoke from British Columbia and Eastern Washington and Montana was so bad and started coming in so thick, literally billowing in like clouds that I could see. And I've had respiratory problems in the past. I literally, I texted a dear friend of mine back home in Port Townsend, which is on the water near the coast. And I said, is there any smoke there? Because if not, I'm gonna bail early on this trip and come home. And she said, nope, it's clear. And so I literally had to pack up after the climb, and instead of staying the extra night and lounging and enjoying the solitude of the mountains and reading a book, I came home and I drove for 3 hours west, and it took almost that entirety of getting all the way basically to just north of Seattle until I emerged back out of the smoke. And it really got me, you know, that's what it's like, you know, when the world is burning and you're surrounded by smoke everywhere and you have sensitive respiratory condition and you can't afford to be in that. And then I also got how lucky and privileged I am that I could just leave and then go to a place where there wasn't smoke. So that really kind of underscored it for me, as well as then knowing that all these people who in California and Oregon, who their houses have burnt down, you know, for them, there's nothing theoretical about this anymore. People in Bangladesh, millions of people that as we speak are having to relocate and find ways to move to higher ground because they live on the biggest river delta in the world and it's flooding because of sea level rise and river floods. There's nothing theoretical to them. You know, the wildfires, you know, the people in the panhandle of Florida or in the Carolinas from the hurricanes this summer who've lost everything. There's nothing theoretical and future about it anymore to them.
Right. And I think this is kind of the thing. We exist, we live here within the United States. It's still technically considered a first world nation, although maybe we're, that's changing, it seems. But It seems like the most vulnerable people in the world, the poorest people in the world, are the ones that are the first to be affected by this. It's all coming back, though. I think was it hens coming home to roost? That kind of is that chickens coming home to roost?
Chickens coming home to roost, and I really think it is. And no matter where we live now, even in the so-called bubble that a lot of the U.S. has been for a long time, none of us are impervious anymore. And I think with time, that's only going to continue to become that much more dramatically apparent. And one thing that I would add, you know, since we really started this talking about this recent IPCC report, is there's a very good Wallace Wells, who he had an article come out about it, because a lot of what we talk about is these degree changes, but a lot of the time people don't really understand the global implications of what it means. And so I, citing him and him authoring this piece that was published in New York Magazine very shortly after the IPCC report that we just spoke about came out, I thought I would read a few paragraphs, because he really puts it very succinctly and very materially what each of these degree changes look like. Bearing in mind, we're at about 1.12C global warming right now. There's this talk about limiting it, trying to limit it to 1.5C rather than 2C. While bearing in mind, right now we are on a trajectory to hit 4C by 2100. If nothing changes, and of course it does appear as though there's not going to be any dramatic changes to curtail that from happening. So now reading what he wrote, at 2C, the melting ice sheets will pass a tipping point of collapse, flooding dozens of the world's major cities this century. At that amount of warming, it's estimated global GDP per capita will be cut by 13%. 400 million more people will suffer from water scarcity. And even in the northern latitudes, heat waves will kill thousands each summer. It will be worse in the planet's equatorial band. In India, where many cities now numbering in the many millions will become unlivably hot, and there will be 32 times as many heat waves, each lasting five times as long and exposing in total 93 times more people. That's at 2 degrees, practically speaking, our absolute best case climate scenario. At 3 degrees, Southern Europe will be in permanent drought. The average drought in Central America will last 19 months, and in the Caribbean, 21 months. In North Africa, the figure is 60 months. That's 5 years. The areas burned each year by wildfires would double in the Mediterranean and sextuple in the United States. Beyond the sea level rise, which will already be swallowing cities from Miami Beach to Jakarta, damages just from river flooding will grow 30-fold in Bangladesh, 20-fold in India, and as much as 60-fold in the UK. This is 3 degrees, better than we'd do if all the nations in the world honored their Paris commitments, which none of them are. Practically speaking, barring those dramatic tech de machina, this seems to me about as positive a realistic outcome as it is rational to expect. At 4 degrees, there would be 8 million cases of dengue fever each year in Latin America alone. Global grain yields could fall by as much as 50%, producing annual or close to annual food crises. The global economy would be more than 30% smaller than it would be without climate change, and we would see at least half again as much conflict and warfare as we do today, possibly more. Our current trajectory, remember, takes us higher still. And while there are many reasons to think we will bend that curve soon, the plummeting cost of renewable energy, the growing global consensus about phasing out coal, it is worth remembering that whatever you may have heard about the green revolution and the price of solar, at present, global carbon emissions are still growing.
That's a good rundown. Thank you for sharing that. So let me just be good devil's advocate, because people, I'm sure, are thinking, well, are there geoengineering schemes that we can possibly throw at this? Can we capture all that extra excess carbon that we've produced over the past several centuries of industrialization? Would that possibly be be a solution. Is there anything that's happening regarding that you know of?
There is currently no technology available that is scalable to a level that would be required to pull as much CO2 out of the atmosphere as possible to prevent us going into basically anything over 2C. There's the one thing I've come across that would be feasible, but this would require literally all global governments going into reacting together as though we're being invaded by hostile aliens. Something you'd see out of a sci-fi movie, like we're going to mandate that all government resources now go into stopping emitting CO2 immediately while simultaneously basically re-fertilizing, recarbonizing soils, planting as many trees as possible, using nature to basically do what nature does and pulling carbon back out of the atmosphere. Stop all deforestation, stop all burning, and actively work to begin re-enriching soils to reabsorb the carbons that current industrial farming practices have been depleting them of for decades now. If that were scalable on a global level, and that's one thing that obviously the technology's there and we know how to do it and we could do it rapidly, but, and this is the kicker, but that would require every global government getting on board with it, i.e. the current modality, which is fossil fuel based, and basically all of every Western economy would have to be abandoned overnight for that to happen, and we see instead going the other trajectory of people voting in or like what just happened in Brazil. Literally, it came out just minutes before we started talking that they've elected essentially the tropical Trump. A madman right wing who's a threat to the democracy, let alone has already talked about mining the Amazon and paving the Amazon and things like this. So instead of what I just described about this rush to if we're going to have a chance at saving humans and numerous other species around the globe by doing something like what I outlined, we appear to be going, stomping on the gas, so to speak.
Yeah, I just pulled up a thing. It reminded me of an article that actually came on the Washington Post. The headline is, Trump administration sees a 7-degree, and they're saying that Fahrenheit, 7-degree rise in global temperatures by 2100. And the article just goes over how the scientists that work within the Trump administration are fully aware that climate change is real, that it's anthropogenic, it's human-caused, and yet they're going full force. They're trying to get the coal industry back in shape. When Trump came in, he started selling off portions of national parks so that they could do mining and fracking and other various extractions. It just sort of exposes the absolutely cynical and psychopathic nature of the institutions that we have and the individuals that exist within them. And I don't know. It's like it's really hard to know what direction to go in, where to put your energy, because it seems that the forces that be, or the powers that be, as it were, are very powerful, and they have their interests in mind, and they're going to continue to do that. I mean, and it doesn't matter what side, you can call yourself a Democrat or Republican or conservative or liberal, but your options for voting, you have either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, but we know that, I'm trying to remember exactly, I want to say it was Hillary Clinton, but I could be wrong, but when it was discussed that the Arctic is melting, that was opening up shipping routes, right? And they were talking about it in a very, like, this is great for business. Like, we can continue to move resources around in a much more efficient way. I think that the climate crisis, and I'm speaking for myself, but I think when you start to really get into it and really grapple with the information, it really speaks to something much deeper than just the climate system. We have an ecological crisis on this planet. The living systems of this planet are being threatened and undermined by the systems that we are a part of, that we perpetuate, that we participate in some fashion, even if we are fully aware of how destructive it is. And so my point in this, I guess this presentation, is to get you to think a little outside of even that, you know, we're coming up against some pretty serious crises here. And the implications are, you know, massive loss of life, not just human life, but life, period. You discussed the last major extinction event in which all that methane was released. 90% of life was destroyed in that. And what does that mean? What does it mean to be alive in this time that we're in? And I know that's something that you grapple with while you're researching the scientific information. You're a human being, Dar. All of us are human. We're trying to grapple with this information, whether it's new to us or not. You know, you talk about going and you wanted to go scale a mountain to sort of clear your mind. You can't even escape it there anymore. So, you know, you're neck deep in this information all the time. I know we're not going to talk about it too much, but you have a book coming out in January dealing with this information. You know, how do you stay grounded in this time that we're in?
No, that's a great question. And I think, you know, as we talk about all of this really challenging information and what it means for us and the rest of the planet, you know, I think the first thing I think I just urge people watching and listening to take it in that, you know, this is our reality, and really let yourself accept that this is happening. You know, this is not a crazy sci-fi movie or book, but this is really, you know, we have caused this, and this is the result of our actions or inactions, and this is happening now. And then second to that, and immediately alongside that really is dealing with the feelings. Like what I talked about is I go into the mountains and seek solace, because I get up in there and I get perspective and can put my hands on rocks or a tree and, okay, this is real, you know, like that. No matter what happens, that mountain's been here way before we were, and it's going to be here way after we're gone, no matter what happens. And that calms me down, you know, and I think each of us needs to, but also, you know, feel that rage, feel that sadness, the fear, the anxiety, and have all the feelings that come with this. I mean, we're talking about the potential extinction of our own species, let alone animal species, plant species, insects, things like this. And this is utterly massive. And I think we have to acknowledge that and let that sink in, and then find other people that we can talk to about this, which is becoming easier. As you said, this one thing that's happened over this last year is things are happening so fast and becoming so much more intense that it does feel like this is becoming more and more common in even mainstream media. I mean, you have even the Trump administration has acknowledged, okay, yeah, it's real. They won't acknowledge how much humans are responsible, but oh, it's this is happening, that it's become even that part of it's become undeniable even to them. And so we have to understand that. And then I think it's at that point, it feels like, I mean, I get into some of my own personal specifics and some other stories around that more in depth in the book that's going to be coming out. But I think it puts all of us in a position like any crisis would, where, you know, we have to get really real about what's really, really important and then make decisions from that place. And for me personally, it means living with that much more reverence toward the earth, that, you know, to know that this is where I came from. You know, I came from this planet, and this is where I live, and this is my place. And I still personally feel very responsible for taking as good a care of it as I can. And then trying to figure out, well, how can I do that amidst this overwhelming, this global crisis that it is overwhelming. And I have to boil that down and make things extremely local. You know, how do I keep reducing my carbon footprint on an annual basis? I live in a solar powered house. I'm growing the majority of my own food now and doing things like that. And do I do it because I think it's going to stop us from going over 2C warming or reaching 4C or 5C or worse? No, I don't, because I don't think it will. But it's the moral thing to do. and it's the right thing to do. And that's some of the things that I've personally started to do and trying to withhold as much judgment as I can on myself and those actions. But it just seems to me like that's still the right and honorable thing to do for the planet, even though we've already really, baked, so to speak. You know, it's, we've already baked, this much change into the system. I mean, another way that I put it when, time is short is, that when I talk to people about, oh, well, can we still change this or what can we do? Well, the oceans of the, and I think we talked about this on your podcast previously, Patrick, the oceans have absorbed 93% of the heat that we've put into the atmosphere. That's enough heat that if the oceans didn't exist, the atmosphere would be 97 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than it is today. My point is, whatever we do to the soil or whatever kind of geoengineering is employed, et cetera, you do not remove that heat from the oceans. And that's locked in, and that's causing bleaching of the coral reefs. It's continuing to acidify. That's actually the brunt of what's driving the majority of the melting now in the Antarctic ice shelf, specifically the Western Antarctic ice shelf, including the Arctic sea ice. It's the hot water. And so we're locked in now, and this is coming. I just think that underscores all the more the relevance of this question of, okay, so, I think it's less what do we do and more how do I be?
Right. I guess that's why I wanted to actually have this kind of discussion, because I tried to tackle this a little bit in a 9.5 minute talk, which you can't do. Right. You can hit some of the major data points in the beginning and then try to talk about, how to live in this time. And it's interesting. You talked about when you went to the mountains to kind of find solace, and there it became very personal to you. And I think all of us have to ask, when does it become personal to us? When does it actually become real? And how are we going to behave in that time when it does become real? I think that what's interesting is, and people use this almost as a way to disparage people who believe in climate change. Al Gore was preaching this shit back in 2007 or something, or whatever that documentary came out. He's a billionaire, millionaire, whatever, and probably flies on private jets. So how can you really take him very seriously? But, the way that he, when he gets to the end, he says, this is sea level rise. Here's all this information. You can go out and get some solar panels. You can start to keep track of how much carbon you've released driving around the city and try to reduce that. You can buy, more efficient light bulbs. What it does is it tries to individualize action, right? I think that that's kind of the thing, is we exist within a socioeconomic paradigm, which says that you are, you pull yourself by your bootstraps, you figure this out. And if all of us can just do that on an individual level, then we can figure this out. That's not what this crisis is asking of us, though. It stands in the face of those cultural values. It's asking us to come together as a community, almost. I feel like if there's any meaningful action, it's in being with each other. Whether or not we know we can fix this or not, right? We may know that we're going to be meeting our extinction. But still, is it still a worthy act to undermine oppressive systems? Is it still a worthy act to try to undermine ways of thinking and feeling in the world that are destructive to other forms of life besides our own? I think it still is. And I think that the climate crisis is actually asking us something. And it's not just the climate crisis, because I pointed to the ecological crisis more broadly. The climate crisis speaks to something that's happening within us internally as well, as individuals and as a collective, how detached we've become from the planet. One indication that was interesting people have brought up is, have you noticed that the bug splatter on your windshield has diminished the past few years? It used to be you'd have a huge amount of bugs just splattered on your windshield. Now it's less than half of that. What does that mean? And that's not just climate change. That's the kind of chemicals we're using to kill off certain undesirable pests or plants as we monoculture this planet to feed cattle and, you know, all this other stuff, right? Yeah, I mean, there's just so much to unpack with all this information, but I think we did a really good job in this about 45 minutes or so that we've talked. And I'm sure that, I hope at least, some people have some questions that maybe have come up during this discussion. Hey, Jordan, hey, do you want people to stand in the middle there? Or how do you want to do that regarding that?
Patrick, you know, one thing I'll put out there while folks are maybe getting lined up there is that just struck me is that I think one reason this is such a challenging thing to talk about and that there aren't any canned answers that we can cover in 9 minutes or 42 minutes or anything else is that this is a new point in our evolution as a species. You know, we're aware of what we've done and we're aware of what's coming. And so I think we have to evolve with this now and kind of make it up as we go along and try stuff that works and try stuff that doesn't work and then learn from that is I feel like this is a new point in our own evolution, both psychologically, philosophically, and spiritually. And I think that's you know, to mean that there isn't going to be just one answer. It's going to be very individual, but also collective at the same time. I just wanted to put that out there, you know, so there's, you know, I think most of the questions are going to continue to be open-ended, as are most of the answers.
Right. I think it's good to learn how to be somewhat comfortable in knowing there aren't answers to certain questions or certain dilemmas. Yeah. I think maybe it's a cultural thing, but we think if there's a problem, we have to find a way to fix it. You know, can we engineer our way out of this problem? And I think a lot of it also is because we exist within a complex society, we have certain individuals or certain groups of individuals that have enormous amount of power. We assume that somebody's going to fix this for us. Elon Musk is going to fix this for us. You know, he's going to launch us into space and we're going to be able to live on Mars. Isn't that amazing? Like, we try to imagine that there's going to be some sort of technology fix to this. And I think we need to get a handle on it and acknowledge and sort of exist within a space of unknowing. Not knowing what's coming, not knowing even what's really happening. You know, I think when you analyze the climate, and this has actually been something that I would say maybe people that are call themselves skeptical or in a state of denial about it, is the climate is so complex that we cannot possibly understand what's happening. And that's true to a degree. As we begin to experience this change, there are variables that were not considered in the initial research. Right, we're really just starting to understand it, but we do have enough we can perceive just well enough to know that this is happening, and it's not good for us. So, yeah, I think that my note would be that. Yeah. Okay. I thank you for sharing that last thought and jumping in there. We'll see if we got any people. People in the group chat, if you want to jump in and ask a question, we'll do that. If anybody here in the audience, I don't know if anybody here has a question. I hope.
I've got a few questions in the live chat. I just sent you a link so you can see it.
Okay, where's it at?
That's going to be, I sent it through Messenger.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to have a live question while
we're pulling it up? Sure, yeah, that'd be great. Is there anybody that's got a question? Got a question, Bowen? You want to come on up here, please?
Perfect. Go ahead and just state your name and your question.
All right. Hey Dar, thank you for chatting with us. Really appreciate it. I'm Bowen. I'm the reporter who interviewed you a couple of days ago.
Oh, hey Bowen. Yeah, good to meet you.
I'm just curious. Are there any other books or other articles that you would recommend seeking out to further our education on this subject?
Oh goodness. Wow. There's so many. You know, one, the first book that comes to mind is Elizabeth Colbert's Six Mass Extinction, which came out a few years ago, but that's a really important book that kind of gives you an idea of what's happening to species, including our own around the world. And of course it's climate related. Another really good one about the Arctic and specifically the sea ice is Dr. Peter Wadhams, mm-hmm. whom I've interviewed several times. He has a book that came out, I believe Penguin published it 2-3 years ago, called Farewell Ice. Okay. And it's he's arguably the most renowned Arctic sea ice expert on the planet. And that's a really, really good book as far as that goes. And then for articles, the person who that I read that bit from, David Wallace Wells, who's written for New York Magazine, and he has another piece that raised, well, caused some very big waves earlier this year when he basically wrote about what happens on Earth with if all the worst case scenarios come true, which is possible. It's not guaranteed, but it's certainly possible, and it's extremely apocalyptic. And at the time, he caught a lot of flack and was heavily criticized for being alarmist and scaring people. But now, I think it's roughly a year later since that article came out, and now it seems notably less far-fetched. Mm. And it's a challenging one to read in that it is very scary, but I think it's an important article. So there's those. And then at the risk of being shamelessly self-promoting, I write a monthly climate, I call it a climate disruption dispatch for Truthout. It's truthout.org. We publish it every Monday. I have one that we'll publish tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And what I do is daily, I'm collating the most recent scientific studies and reports, as well as extreme weather events that are clearly tied to climate disruption, at least in some part, which all of them are now. And I pull it all together. I usually introduce it with, a personal story. Mm-hmm. And then that's basically a way that people can, once a month, you're going to have the most updated studies that have come out, because there's so many. They're all around the world. It's a difficult, and I don't pretend to keep up with all of them. But, you know, every month it's 2,500 to 3,000 words of, you know, here's where we're at. This is what's happened in the last 30 days. Mm-hmm. So those are, that's probably enough to have you read, and probably need to get a psychologist to get started.
Great. Thank you for the recommendations. I appreciate it. And I'll take it.
Hey, I'm the moderator. Don't mind me. I'm just pulling up some questions from the chat. I've got a couple that people have been asking. The biggest one is when your book is coming out and where they can get it.
Yeah, the book's called The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. It's going to be published by The New Press, and it's coming out January 15th, and you can pre-order it now through all the usual ways, directly through The New Press website, Amazon, et cetera.
Excellent. Thanks a bunch. I had a great question from Antonio Reed. He's in the chat. I hope I got your name right, Antonio. He said, what are your thoughts on the immigrant caravan? Is this a sign of what's coming in the future? And do you think it will turn violent?
I can't speak as to whether it will turn violent unless they're still weeks away from the U.S. border. If it turned violent, it would be because U.S. soldiers decided to start firing on them, probably. I don't think the violence would come from the caravan. I'd be shocked if it did. But I see this as very directly correlated to climate disruption, as so much of the violence across the Middle East and the migrations that we're seeing there now. If you look at the climate models and NASA's projections, Central America, it's becoming increasingly challenging because of droughts, floods, and extreme weather events for agriculture to continue as normal there. And that's pushed more and more people into the cities looking for other jobs, which is causing these gangs and violence and instability, which is causing people to try to migrate to some place where there's just basic security and they can just get food and water. It always comes down to that. So unfortunately, I think this caravan is symptomatic of that. And I think that we would have, I don't know if it'd be in the form of caravans, but certainly bigger and more consistent migrations of people both north and south out of Central America. Because if you look at the climate modeling, by 2100, if you look at the worst case projections, basically Central America is just drought alone. It's agriculture. It's going to be really, really challenging to grow much of anything there. Not even to talk about the kind of drought, flooding, extreme weather event combo that itself is kind of the terrible triad for agriculture. So I think absolutely this is a tip of the iceberg situation, unfortunately.
Thanks a bunch. Yeah, let's grab anyone in the audience. Yeah, come on up, man.
Hi, Dar. I'm Victor.
Hi, Victor.
I was curious when you talked about the mountain trip and trying to clear your head, the whole dealing with this, researching this stuff, and how much of a toll that took on you to have to do that. I'm curious if you could describe a little more of what that is like to live like that day to day, to go through this stuff, and how tough it is to on you personally.
That's a good question. I mean, I personally walk a very fine line of things that I need to do to kind of keep a balance between, you know, the weight and the gravity of what I'm writing about regarding the climate and you know, other things like this political catastrophe that's also happening across the U.S. and now, you know, Brazil and other places around the world, you know, balancing that, which, you know, not just me as a writer, but I think anyone that's really consistently consuming the news pretty steadily on a daily basis is going to have to deal with this. And so, you know, it's time with really, really good friends, and it's talking about this stuff on a regular basis with people that also see clearly what's going on and the ramifications of it. And I bring up the mountain trip because if I can't get to the mountains, it's very important for me to go out into the garden and get my hands in the dirt and look at the trees and just be in the trees and with the trees and hear the birds and just daily connection to the planet, just to kind of ground like a lightning rod, if you will. Because if I don't do that stuff, and I, after my first big book trip a couple of years ago, I came back from Alaska and just went right into writing and pulling a lot of really intense information together about what was happening in Alaska. And I stopped doing the earth connection. Within about 3 weeks was heavily depressed. So I, you know, it's consistently time with friends and time on the planet. And I really can't afford to let up on any of that stuff. As well as, you know, I personally have a spiritual practice that involves daily meditation and some other things. And I have to really be diligent about that too. Otherwise, it's just really easy to spin out.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good question.
All right. Jordan, help me figure out how to check out the chat. Thank you, Jordan. I got a question from Rob Simetz, and I know Rob. He's become a friend of mine. Rob asked, Dar, I am going to be a father in 3 months, and what I constantly think about is how to explain this to my son. Have you ever talked to kids about climate change, and how do we talk to children about this?
That is a very good, very important, very hard question. I do not have kids. I chose not to have my own kids. I've not talked to real young kids. I've talked to, I think the youngest kids I've talked to about this are folks in their early 20s, who pretty much already get it. You know, I did speak to, I spent time last week with a class from Evergreen State University, just south of here in Olympia. You know, so some 19 and 20 year olds, and they all got it. I mean, that was one thing that I actually found refreshing, is I found that the most people in the younger generations, I mean, I guess unless they're, you know, studying to be corporate fascists, they really get it. They really get climate change. They get that we're in it deep, and they get that the future is going to be very intense. But particularly people with kids, I think it's going to be very important to explain to the child when the time is right. And I have no idea at what age or when that's going to be, but let them know what's happening and let them know that they're living in a rapidly changing world, as well as why the decision was made to bring them in. You know, it was probably made because there's a lot of love And that wanted to be expressed in this forum, and that the parents probably still thought it was possible to do that even against the backdrop of this climate catastrophe that's upon us. And, you know, I guess one analogy I might make is that working in Iraq for as long as I did, when times got extremely intense, like when Fallujah was sieged and hundreds of thousands of refugees streaming into Baghdad, what I saw is that alongside with the barbarism that comes out in war of horrible things being done by the occupation force Americans, but alongside that were amazing acts of humanity that, you know, people just, you know, the love and the care, people just taking people into their homes that they didn't even know, sharing everything they had with them. That was actually far, far more common than looting and other negative things. And so I think there's going to be obviously a lot of room to practice that coming up. And I'm not trying to intentionally just put a silver lining on this thing, but I think that's another part of the equation that might help somehow when it comes to talking about children about that. But that's a great question. And it's one that I definitely intend on exploring in the future, whether it's by interviewing psychologists or, you know, but probably by talking with people who already have kids or have made the decision to have kids who are really handling it the right way.
Thank you for that question. And thank you for that answer. I think we'll do two more questions. If anybody in the audience has one right now, and then I'll do one more here on the live stream. Does anybody have a question?
Hello, thank you. Thank you, Dar, and thank you, Patrick, for putting this performance on. It's informational, and I think it's really important. But my question is, I understand that I can make a difference with climate change, and I'm not trying to diminish that, but I think that there's a disproportionate percent that can make a difference. And I recently there was an article, I don't know who it was or who wrote it, but it was multinational corporations, and there are maybe like 100 or so that are disproportionately responsible for our carbon emissions. And I know that I can make a difference personally, but I feel like maybe not changing or changing my actions, but maybe voting with my dollar and influencing these corporations. And is this true? Is there a bigger percent out there that's the corporations causing this change versus individuals? And if you could address that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, unequivocally, that's the fact. Well, for clarity, the single biggest CO2 emitter on the planet is the U.S. military. So that needs to be stated. Second to that, I believe is The Guardian published an article within the last year and a half or so. And I think it was something like 17 international corporations that were responsible for this. I'm not going to quote the percentage, but I think we can say the majority of the CO2 emissions, and most of them obviously are fossil fuel companies, so oil companies to be specific. So without a doubt, finding out who and what those are, and Patrick, you alluded to this earlier, and then making a concerted effort to try to stop that from happening in whatever way necessary, whether it's voting with your dollars or organizing a boycott campaign, et cetera, obviously would be a very fortuitous thing to do, I think.
I do one more question here from the live chat. Hey, Dar, thank you. Oh, this, by the way, is from Dominic. I think I know who this is. Hey, Dar, thank you for this. What do you think indigenous perspectives can offer us in dealing with the climate disaster?
That is another excellent question. I actually get into that at the end of my book because I really struggled with how to end the book big time. I basically didn't know how. And then a series of events happened that brought the indigenous perspective front and center in my life. So I'm not going to give away the ending of my book before it's released. But I think I don't think I can state strongly enough that I think most, if not all, of our answers to how to have perspective on this and how to deal with it are going to come from indigenous populations around the world. And I'll just leave it at that.
All right, Dar, we have approached our hour with you. Thank you so much for taking the time. If you want to hang out for a second, I'll talk to you after we're after this. But we're only halfway through this. The second half is going to be with Dr. Bones, and it's going to get really weird. And yeah, so thank you so much, Dar. I greatly appreciate this. This was difficult, I think, but I admire you greatly for your work. And yeah, thank you.
Likewise, Patrick. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Okay. All right, guys. We'll take like a 5 to 10 minute intermission. Thank you so much. I'll play a couple songs and then we'll start back up. All right. Thank you.